Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Some might say Murfreesboro and Rutherford County residents are a bit obsessed with the Civil War. After all, it's an essential part of the town's history, the area's history. The Battle of Stones River, Nathan Bedford Forrest raid on the town, the northern occupation of the town square, they're all part of the county's DNA, and the roots run deep. But what was life like for the townspeople during that period? Former MTSU staffer Shirley Ferris-Jones and Michael Bradley, Professor Emeritus of History at Motlow State Community College, explore that territory in Murfreesboro in the Civil War, a new book from the History Press. It goes from Tennessee's secession to the onset of the antebellum period, and we'll talk with Shirley and Michael right after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. The James E. Walker Library has new and expanded hours this academic year at students' request. The new hours are Sunday, 1 p.m. to 2 a.m., Monday through Thursday, 7 a.m. to 2 a.m., Friday, 7 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Four MTSU students were sworn in August 23rd as full-fledged U.S. Army cadets and members of the Blue Raider Battalion. The four, freshman Allison Judkins of Murfreesboro, sophomore Ryan McCoy of Nashville, freshman Keegan Roberts of Summertown, Tennessee, and junior Zachary Bennett of Louisville, Kentucky, successfully completed a physical fitness test that included 2 minutes of push-ups, 2 minutes of sit-ups, and a 2-mile run. They have contracted to become commissioned officers after graduation. For MTSU News Anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Shirley Ferris-Jones joins us here in studio, and Michael Bradley joins us via telephone from Tullahoma, Tennessee. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to be with you.
I'll start out with you, Shirley. So much has been said and written about the Civil War, especially in this neck of the woods. Why did you believe that there was still a wealth of information to be tapped and revealed, enough to make a new book?
There's always something new to be told. A new diary, a new letter surfaces from that period in time, and there's always another story. There's always one more line of thought, perhaps, that comes from that era that is worthy of our delving into it.
But this doesn't go through military strategy and battles so much as it takes a look at the human side of the war, right?
This is Murfreesboro's story. This is the story of the townspeople, Murfreesboro's citizens. What happened to the town? What happened to her people during that particular period of time?
And there is a passage from page 35 and 36 that I found particularly interesting. I wanted to read that, and I guess I'll get your reaction to this, Michael. This is notes taken by John Beatty during his time in Murfreesboro. March 30th, 1862 entry says, "The colored people of Murfreesboro pour out in great numbers on Sunday evenings to witness dress parade, some of them in excellent holiday attire." He observes, "Murfreesboro is an aristocratic town. Many of the citizens have as fine carriages as are to be seen in Cincinnati or Washington. The ladies, so far as I can judge by a glimpse through a carriage window, are richly and elegantly dressed. The poor whites are as poor as rot, and the rich are very rich. There is no substantial well-to-do middle class. The slaves are, in fact, the middle class here. They are not considered so good, of course, but a great deal better off than the white trash." Is Beatty's observation an accurate description of the sort of socioeconomic divide in the town at the time?
Well, Beatty's speaking with a certain degree of ethnocentrism, isn't he? I'm not sure most people would have called Cincinnati an elegant and civilized town. Certainly, Cincinnati was still something of a raw western riverport town at that time. So you have to allow for a certain degree of exaggeration in his characterization. But, yes, he is on to something there when he comments that there were a number of very wealthy people. And what we know of as the middle class is really more of a creation of the 20th century than it was of the mid-19th.
Did you and Shirley do any interviews with any descendants of Confederates?
We're both descendants of Confederates. And we were not here at the time of the battle.
No, not even I. No, actually, that was not the focus, to see what the descendants thought, but rather to see what the people who were here at the time thought, as best we could determine that by the record they left behind them.
But were the descendants
to say we did not speak to any descendants? That's not entirely true, because there were people who volunteered to allow us access to family letters, diaries, and that sort of thing. But we did not interview the descendants as a part of the research.
Well, that was more what I meant, that they were able to provide you with information about their forebears that you could use for the book.
Yes, for instance, we tracked down one, I think, absolutely beautiful reminiscence of an early teenage girl who was a relative of Charles Anderson, a resident in the outskirts of Murfreesboro, and an important businessman, vice president of the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad, but serving on the military staff of Bedford Forest. And her diary, in typical early teenage fashion, recorded that Uncle Charlie came home last night and Mr. Forrest came with him. Oh, and I had the honor, she says, of darning Mr. Forrest's pants while he was here.
Did she provide any of her impressions of Mr. Forrest himself?
No, just that his pants had a hole in the seat. that's sort of the expression you would expect from an early teenager who's looking at the immediate and the obvious.
Well, it could have been a much more interesting story, because when Mike and I were talking about this is the diary of Florence Henderson. She was an ancestor of Bubba Woodfin, the Bubba Woodfin family.
And Woodfin's still an important name in this town.
Absolutely. And so Mike said, well, he had heard about this. He'd made a note of it, about this young girl darning forest drawers. Now, that, you'll have to admit, that would have been very interesting. So I had never heard that. So, I really began to search for anything, you know, about someone who had done such a favor for General Forrest. And then it came back to the Henderson diary, I found, this was something that was published in a Historical Society publication, in the 1970s. And the diary itself is in the possession of Love Beasley, Bubba's sister. And so I spoke with Bubba, and I spoke with her, and they quickly corrected me that this was not, she did not darn Forrest drawers, but she darned his trousers. So, you know, we wanted to make sure we got that accurate.
Well, yes, propriety of the era being what it should have been and all that. What kind of shape is that diary in?
I have not seen it. I would say that the Woodvins have preserved it as to the best degree possible.
It does sort of put a different face on Bedford Forrest to think of that fierce warrior sitting beside the fireplace wrapped up in a blanket while somebody darns a hole in the seat of his pants.
I don't think there's a hole in the seat of his pants in that statue that's on the interstate in Nashville.
Oh. I've never looked myself.
The horse is in bad shape.
We'll have more in just a moment. This is MTSU on the record.
Tennessee's farm families contribute to our state's economy, nutrition, and culture. The Tennessee Century Farms program at MTSU's Center for Historic Preservation acknowledges farms that have been in the same family for at least 100 years. To date, the program has certified more than 1,000 farms. This is Kenita Hankins, director of the Tennessee Century Farms program.
And for all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the book Murfreesboro in the Civil War with former MTSU staffer Shirley Ferris-Jones and Michael Bradley, who is Professor Emeritus of History at Motlow State Community College. Were most of the sources for your information for this book local, that is to say within the county, or did you also find things in the state archives and other places?
You always find things at the state archives. But a great deal of the information was there on the MTSU campus in the Gore Research Center. Then, of course, the Linebaugh Public Library has a good collection of newspapers from that period. And then, naturally, we had to go to the battlefield, because the battlefield archives include things that happened in town, not just what was going on the battlefield itself. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Bob Womack was a dear friend of mine, one of my coffee-drinking buddies during the years I worked at MTSU. And many years back, he came to coffee one day, and, oh, he was so excited. He had found the diary of Sally Ivers. And we exchanged Civil War stories, and Dr. Bob and I talked Civil War. We almost OD'd on Civil War sometimes. But he had the Sally Ivers diary, and a 14-year-old girl's account of Forest Raid in Murfreesboro. And it was very exciting at that time. I had never used research from it in any of my writings or anything, but Mike found that at the Gore Center, among the Dr. Bob's collection that is housed there. And so when he sent this to me, I thought, gee, this sure sounds familiar. And it was the young girl's diary, Sally Ivers, that Dr. Bob Womack had uncovered back in the 80s sometime.
Teenagers grew up fast in that era. They had to, I suppose.
You look at the lifespan, you know, what, 45 to 47 years old. That was, most women didn't make it beyond that.
One thing I wanted to ask was with regard to the photographs, the photo on page 70, which depicts the three cousins, mm-hmm. Thomas Benton Smith, DeWitt Smith Job, and DeWitt Smith. They're standing in front of some kind of a backdrop, which I don't know whether it's the Confederate flag or not, but there are stars on it, some kind of patriotic backdrop.
That was the Stars and Bars. That picture is complimentary picture from John Bridges. He did a book on the three cousins from Mechanicsville, and that was a photo that he used in his book, so he was kind enough to allow us to use it in ours.
And what is the story of these three cousins?
It's a very tragic story. Thomas Benton Smith, DeWitt Smith Job, and the three cousins, and DeWitt Smith.
Yeah.
They were all from the area of Mechanicsville, which is not far from Nolensville. It's in Rutherford County. They all enlisted in the Confederate Army. Thomas Benton Smith was known as the Boy General. He rose to the rank of Brigadier General at a very early age. DeWitt Smith Job was a Coleman Scout who served with Sam Davis. He was captured and tortured by some men from an Ohio unit. It was an absolutely horrible, tragic thing. It's not recorded in the military annals, you know. I guess the federal soldiers just forgot to write that one down, as they did some other atrocities that were committed.
And where did you find out about the torture?
There have been articles written about it. There again, I used John Bridges' book, but it's been recorded in his history books, and the story has not been told as widely, kind of like some of the John Hunt Morgan stories. You know, it has not been told as much, perhaps, as it should have, but mm-hmm. Thomas Benton Smith.
Actually, some of the people who found his body wrote an article about it, which was published in the Confederate Veteran magazine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Everywhere except in the official military records.
That's true.
And DeWitt Smith avenged his cousin's murder. Well, he went on kind of a killing spree. He actually began his tirade before Thomas Benton Smith was, before DeWitt Smith Job was tortured and killed. So, you know, there's a little gray area where he's concerned. Thomas Benton Smith was surrendered at the Battle of Nashville. He was struck in the head by a bayonet of, Mike, I can't think of the Union officers.
One of the officers he surrendered to was just so angry that he hit him in the head.
And he was drunk, I believe, wasn't he?
Probably.
Uh-huh. And so that was a very tragic end. He spent a lot of his life in an insane asylum, and he attended, reunions with his men when he could. And it was just, a life wasted. All three of these young men, so full of promise and hope at the beginning of the war, met such a tragic, tragic end.
Smith lived until well into the 20th century, by the way.
Mm-hmm. DeWitt Smith is the only clean-shaven one in this photograph. He looks like he's the youngest of the three, is he?
They're all approximately the same age. Mm-hmm. Those beards are deceiving.
Okay. Yeah. And he was the one who perhaps had the most tragic life of mm-hmm. the three of them.
Living so much of his life mm-hmm. Mentally impaired because of a wound he received after he had surrendered.
They didn't think that he would live. When he was taken to the hospital after being struck in the head with a bayonet, they talked about how his brain was oozing, his skull was split. It was just absolutely horrible.
How did the townspeople, going to a slightly more festive subject, react to the betrothals of the Reeves sisters to a couple of Yankee soldiers?
You know, I don't know. I imagine somebody got the vapors.
Did you find any diary accounts of that one?
The only diary
account. Well, you have to remember that people's opinions, some people's opinions would shift as readily as the wind, depending on who happened to be in town on any given day.
The Reeves family.
I'm sure there were some people who went by and told them, "Congratulations, girls, this is a wonderful thing," and I'm sure there were others who Shirley says never spoke to them again.
They were shunned from polite society. I'll bet you they weren't invited to Maddie Reedy Morgan's wedding.
I suspect they did not get an invitation to Morgan's wedding. Sure.
But the girl's mother apparently was dead. Their father was Nathan B. Reeves, and they lived with their grandmother, who had a boarding house, and that was in the Sally Ivers diary. And I had trouble. I do know that Parkhurst came back and did marry Josephine, and they lived in Nashville for 3 years before she died. Mm-hmm. But Rounds, O.C. Rounds, sent a letter back breaking the engagement to Corinne, and he never came back to Murfreesboro. And she remarried, you know, she married somebody else and hopefully had a very respectable life.
Actually, marrying across political lines is not as uncommon as we sometimes think. Remember, Adelicia Ackland in Nashville married a man from the north.
That was to save her plantation.
Right, and then the famous Confederate spy, Belle Boyd, married three times, and the last time she married was a man from Wisconsin.
What was the size of the Union Loyalist population in Murfreesboro and Rutherford County, if any?
Well, it depends on who happens to be in town that day.
Okay.
Remember that Murfreesboro city government refused to surrender, therefore the town was officially captured rather than surrendered. But then soon after that, the Union occupying force under General Mitchell was able to find some civilians who were willing to serve in the pro-Union town government. Of course, when Mitchell left after Forrest's raid and the Confederates returned, that government disappeared, and for the rest of the war, Murfreesboro was under military occupation rather than under civilian law.
So it was more about who was in power at any given time than it was about ideology.
For a lot of people, that was quite very much the case. Whatever your opinions are, it's probably best to keep them to yourself, particularly when you don't know who's going to be in charge of the town next.
Yeah. Okay.
And I might add that same attitude affected the attitude of the African American society, most of whom were slaves. No matter how anxious you might be to gain your freedom and to express your independence, you need to be very careful about that until you're sure that it's entirely safe to do that sort of thing.
We'll talk more about the African American community when we come back. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about Murfreesboro in the Civil War, a book by Michael Bradley and Shirley Ferris Jones. What, and this is for either one of you who wants to jump in, what was Fortress Rosecrans and what impact did it have on African Americans?
It gave them employment, a way to make money and a way to survive. Fortress Rosecrans, of course, is the largest earthen fortress of its kind. It was kind of a depot. It was it encompassed, a huge amount of acreage.
Over 200 acres.
But with the Emancipation Proclamation going into effect in January, even though it did not affect, the local slaves, because Tennessee was a Confederate state, under federal occupation, but it gave the African Americans a source of employment, a source, of a way to make money and to survive.
Mm-hmm. And did they live on the premises?
Oh, no.
No, there were army barracks inside the fortress, but the population, well, the laboring population, the people who worked on the fort, either lived in town or in temporary quarters that were along the railroad.
And this was named after a General Rosecrans, right?
After William Stark Rosecrans, who commanded the Army of the Cumberland, the Northern Army, during the Battle of Stones River, on through the Tullahoma Campaign, and on through the Battle of Chickamauga, yeah.
Okay. Tell us.
Actually, at the time, Rosecrans is as well known as Ulysses Grant. The difference is Rosecrans finally lost the battle and got himself relieved from command, and Grant kept on winning.
Were there any units of colored troops in the area?
There were two. The 13th USCT, to use the official government designation of that day, was raised in Murfreesboro and became extremely well known. And of course, their history and their military contribution is memorialized, among other places, at Bradley Academy there in Murfreesboro today. The 111th USCT was stationed in Murfreesboro toward the end of the war, and they're the people who helped to create the National Cemetery. The engineer was assigned to lay out the cemetery, but the 111th USCT actually dug the graves, found the bodies, brought them there, reinterred them, and built the original stone fence around the cemetery.
Shirley, let's talk about something that you referenced a moment ago, and that is the wedding of General John Hunt Morgan and Martha Reedy. It happened on December 14, 1862, mm-hmm. and it sounds like it was something that brought a little bit of joy and festivity into what would otherwise been a very dreary time.
It has become known as the social highlight of the Confederacy. Jefferson Davis had been in town a couple of days before he promoted Morgan to Brigadier General. He was not here at the time of the wedding, but everybody who was anybody and their wives were here. I mean, what more could a young lady ask for than to have, you know, so many exciting people at her wedding? However, Maddie was not able to get a wedding dress. She wore one of her best antebellum frocks, as Basil Duke, Morgan's brother-in-law and best friend, recounted later. But it was the event of all events, you know, for the townspeople. And the day after the wedding, there was a grand ball held in the courthouse. I mean, this was just, you know, just a wonderful dream, which quickly turned into a nightmare a couple of weeks later with the Battle of Stones River and everything. But Maddie was a woman ahead of her time. She was such a perfect match for John Morgan. And John Morgan was... He was a very exciting cavalryman, the dashing, daring cavalryman from Kentucky. I've referred to him numerous times in that way. But it was just a perfect match, and Morgan, for the first time in his life, I contend, was truly a man in love.
He looks in this picture kind of like Matthew Broderick in Glory.
You know, I hadn't thought about that.
He's got that kind of a boyish face, even mm-hmm. though he mm-hmm. does have a mustache mm-hmm. and a little bit of a goatee. But little did they know that all of this gaiety was going to mark the end of an era.
That's right. It certainly did. Literally gone with the wind.
Ironically, the man who killed Morgan was camped on the outskirts mm-hmm. of Murfreesboro on the day of the wedding.
Part of Claiborne's command.
The Confederate mm-hmm. Army, and would later desert.
Mm-hmm. Part of Claiborne's command at that time.
Yes.
Not a very long honeymoon.
Not very. No. They spent their first night of married life together, as family legend holds, in the Reedy house, Maddie's grandfather's house at Reedyville, you know, the mm-hmm. big brick two-story house that's still standing. I understand it's just been sold again. And the bedroom where they spent the night had an outside entrance, and lots of famous people had come through and spent the night at the Reedy home. And so this was where Maddie and John stayed.
Their first separation would come only a few days after mm-hmm. the wedding, when Morgan would ride off on a raid into Kentucky, appropriately called the Christmas Raid. And he would be gone for approximately 2 weeks, including the time when the battle at Murfreesboro was being fought, so that Maddie was there by herself, well, with her family, while her new husband was away in Kentucky, totally out of touch with her. She had no idea what was happening to him during those 2 weeks.
But they wrote lots of interesting letters.
They did indeed.
Very, very devoted. And, of course, Maddie, but more or less, you know, the wife of a Confederate general that the Yankees would love to have gotten a hold of. But she and her sister Alice fled Murfreesboro after the Battle of Stones River. Of course, you know, part of that, Maddie wanted to be with her husband whenever she could, and so she went, you know, to Tullahoma to Mack Mendville. She followed him wherever she could. Their marriage lasted a total of 630 days. But when Maddie left, little did she know that she would not see her parents again until July of 1865. Her younger sister, Ella Cheatham, would die in the interim. And when Maddie returned to Murfreesboro in July of 65, she would be a young widow with a three-month-old child.
Where did you find Maddie and John's love letters? Where were they?
They're part, let's see, they have been published in Catherine Jones' books that she has written. Part of them are, a part of the letters had been preserved. Maddie burned the letters after she married William H. Williamson and moved to Lebanon. As her health declined, she did not preserve them. But Alice, her sister, Alice Martin, who also lived in Lebanon, did preserve some of them, and they are at the Southern Historical Collection.
Didn't Jefferson Davis himself set foot in Murfreesboro once upon a time?
He was here 2 days before the wedding. He was not here at the time of the wedding. He was on a train to Montgomery, Alabama at the time Maddie and John were married, but he was here the day before.
And was accompanied by the oldest son of Robert E. Lee.
That's pretty rich company for that time.
Yes, it was certainly a distinguished event in the life of Murfreesboro.
So he didn't stay terribly long then?
He was here for 2 days. He promoted Morgan to Brigadier General during that time.
And held some conferences, tried to settle some differences. It was strictly a business trip for Davis. Mm-hmm.
So he didn't really stay here long enough to get the flavor of the town and or the town to get the flavor of him.
He stayed at Oakland's, and the Manny family made him very comfortable, I understand that.
We'll take one more brief break and be back with more on MTSU on the Record after this.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're wrapping up our conversation with Shirley Ferris Jones, former MTSU staffer, and Michael Bradley, Professor Emeritus of History at Motlow State Community College, on their book Murfreesboro and the Civil War. Shirley, I interviewed you before about another book that you worked on, and it seems like every time you dig into a book, it's a labor of love for you.
Absolutely. There's so many wonderful stories just waiting to be told, and to preserve just one little piece of history, just to make sure that it's not forever lost, whether it's my family or someone else's, or just a piece of our local history. I just feel that is my passion. I just feel that I just feel really good about it.
How did you decide who was going to do what in terms of contributions to the book?
We didn't.
Well, Shirley knows all the good stories, so Shirley's job was to tell all those good stories. My job was to sit around and dust the dust off the old manuscript.
Well, we had an outline.
That sort of thing.
And we followed the outline, and each one of us contributed what we had and what fit where. And Mike did a wonderful job in laying out the format of the book, and my job was very easy, actually.
Murfreesboro in the Civil War by Michael R. Bradley and Shirley Ferris Jones. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.